time for our second session. I got some good news here. We have a Unix 7 guru here who told me that Windows 7, duh. Yeah, Windows 7, is that it's possible under Windows 7, and certainly is also under Macs, to bring up a command line and Java's installed, so you're able then to run Java or Java P. And for the gentleman that we were just talking with, he had the problem that he had compiled the program and it happened to be one that wanted to read input. And the question is how to do that. One simple way to do it, one way to do it is in Eclipse. Just tell Eclipse treat this not as a build.xml build, but as a normal run. But even simpler would be to bring up command line to take the class file and just run Java and the name of whatever that class is. And Java will then start executing, and it will then just, if you have input, allow you to type after that line the input that you want it to read. So standard input would be rather much like Unix and other languages. Start the command line. If it wants to read input, you just type it if it's reading from standard input, which it is. And what, command D, control D?
Windows R will bring up the little run dialog. You just type CMD and it'll pull up the command line.
Cool. Okay. And will you have time at some point maybe to write?
I can put that on Piazza.
Yeah, and the gentleman will put it up in the Piazza and you can count on and access that. So that's really the point I was trying to make earlier is Eclipse is cool in its own way, but it also extracts a price and complexity. But once you've got something that's compiling .class files, as CSX is, you don't really need Eclipse anymore. You certainly can use it. But something simpler, like simply say, Java, please take this class file and run it. If it has no inputs, it'll simply run and print out whatever it's going to print out, or crash if it's going to crash. Probably not, but maybe. But if it's going to have standard input, it's just like the old days where you start a program. If it wants, you know, type 1 and 2, you type 1, space 2, return, and it'll read it. And whatever it is on Windows, on Unix, usually the end of input is control D. And on Windows, it's probably something different, but something equally simple. So that solves a couple of problems, and I'm glad we were able to get that resolved. Okay, let's bring this guy back to life. Okay, so when we broke, we were just at the point here where we had tricked Java into calling our main routine by essentially having a dummy, a little stub, as it were, that is in the standard form, main, that takes an array of strings, and saying, all I want you to do is call my main, which is what the user thinks execution begins with. So you've done a couple of extra steps. Yeah, question? Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely. But that's the cool thing about, let me explain that. That's only in terms of when I'm executing. When I call somebody else, as we'll see down below, it'll have its own limit. So if I call some guy who's greedier, he'll put his own limit up there. But you're onto something, because one of the issues is we haven't talked yet how to estimate what the depth of an operand stack is going to be. You're probably going to hold your nose, and if so, you know, get practice now. Is what we're going to do is simply guesstimate what it is and give a large number. But there is a way of doing it, but it's a tricky thing. It's rather similar to if you have a program in conventional language. One of the questions that people write in compiler business is, how many registers does it really need if we had registers? We have stack instead. And that's not an easy question to answer. And a lot of times people do all sorts of analyses. So one of the questions I have in old exams is, if you really wanted an honest-to-gosh number, how would you figure it out? Turns out the way you do it is look at the generated code and on an instruction-by-instruction basis, trace what it's doing to the stack. Pushes make the stack deeper. Pops make the stack more shallow. Operations may leave the stack the same or increase it or decrease it, but it's always by a known amount. So essentially, you go through the instructions saying, what did you do to the stack, and you, and you, and you, and you. At this stage, I don't want to have that level of complexity necessary, so we're going to do a cheat. But it's a cheat that usually works, but not inevitably. But I'll also tell you the correct way of doing it. So that's what that is. But it's an important point thing. This is only for this particular method. Similarly, it'd be a situation here where later on I'll say, how many locals do I need? It's only for me. If I call somebody else who has a ton of locals, he'll, in his own definition, have accounted for that. So each of us do our own job right, and we count on everybody else doing their job right, and business prospers, we hope. So we were right at this point where this is the main that the user actually created. So let's look at that again. This is actually, the main is the entire program. So in this case, there's going to be a declaration of an int. Since it's uninitialized, this thing will not generate visible code, but it'll have a side effect of saying, I want a local variable. And we'll have a little list of how many locals were requested and make sure we have that available. We'll see how that appears. We'll then do a read. How are we going to do a read? The way every language in the world does a read, we're in call library routine. In our case, we're going to have a little library called CSX Live, the CSX library. If you want extra credit, here's one way you could do it, is namely enhance that library. We have routines for the basics, reads, and writes of the basic types. But you can imagine having some fancier routines. How would you do them? This is the cool thing. Remember, we're in Java land. So if you want to create a fancy library routine, either find it in the existing library routines or write it in Java. And there's no reason why CSX can't call Java library routines. So you could have a much richer environment for CSX by simply doing that in Java. You'd do it in Java because it's a fuller language than CSX. But CSX is able to inherit anything that Java has available, and we can build on that. So what's going to happen is we'll see is read is going to call our own little library routine. In this case, is reading an int. It'll go ahead, and you can actually see the source code, and all I do is use Java code that has the equivalent of a read, read it, and get it put on the stack so it's available for execution. And then we do a print. A print's going to call CSX Live routines that print strings or integers or characters, and essentially it'll call Java routines, simple ones, but you can imagine having fancier ones if you wanted, for example, extra credit to have some fancier I/O routines or maybe add some extra routines. If you wanted to have predefined methods, we don't have square root, for example, not a great deal of demand for that when you don't have fractions, when you don't have real numbers, but you can imagine if I wanted to put square root in there, I could add it to CSX Live, have my code generator know about predefined routines and call square root or whatever you think is a valuable addition. So anyway, that's a little look ahead. Let's go back to the code then. It says, okay, I'm the method static main. I take no parameters and my result is void. And the end of the method is all the way down to the bottom there. So that's the end of the method right down there. So this is the entire translation. The first thing we do is translate the integer declaration, but it generates no code because there's no initialization. Remember, there's a default initialization Java does for us, and we'll live with that. So invisibly, the code generator is reserved space for one variable. Later on down below, when we say, how many locals do I need right down there, it's going to say one because I've seen that declaration. I remember I had one declaration. So it says, what I want to do first is read an integer. So I go into CSX Live. That's the library I created, very simple little thing. It's got a method in there called readInt. And whenever I want to read an integer, it reads an integer, takes no parameters because it's reading from standard input, and it leaves its result on the stack like a function. So it says the effect of this is to read an integer and put it on the stack. And what I'm going to do with that, remember that was an assignment that I was reading into variable A, I believe. Was it A? See how good my memory is. Yeah, it was A. Good. Got at least a decent memory. So what it's going to do is it's going to store that into where? Well, in this particular case, it's going to store it into local zero. Like all good computer languages, it starts counting at the wrong spot. And again, it's always a situation. You know, it's just like arrays. When I first learned arrays, it took me forever to say, you know, there's got to be a zeroth element for an array. And does anybody know really why arrays started counting at zero? Was this some deep mathematical property? Well, absolutely right. The way arrays were created was they took the name of the array as the starting point of the data allocation. It took the index and multiplied it by the size of the data. So say integers are 4. So let's take the index plus 4 and use that as an offset. If I start counting at 4, the offset would be 1 times 4 is 4, and 4 bytes, namely offset 0, 1, 2, 3, will be lost. So it says, oh, gee, memory is a terrible thing to lose. Back those days it was. So it says, what if we started counting at zero? Then the very first allocation would be 0 times 4 is 0. Add 0 to the starting address, and that's the starting address. So simply to make sure we did not lose 4 bytes of valuable memory, array started counting at 0. And you had to learn all this stuff. Oh, no, I don't, you know, and just think of how many errors there must have been in the history of computing that you mentally start indexing at 1, and you forget to subtract the 1. So you take the index you really wanted, subtract 1 for it, give it the index that C or Java or whatever really wants, and away you go. So it's one of those situations. So in this particular case, it's following the bad precedent and saying, we have 1 local, but we're going to start counting at 0. So this thing says store 0. iStore means, in this case, iStore says store an integer. The I says integer. Store means store. And it's going to be storing at a local slot. And the slot happens to be offset 0 because that's the very first variable goes. If I had another variable, it would be offset 1, offset 2, etc. So it's really saying store it at the 0th variable in the frame. And the 0th is actually the first that we created, which is A. So this is a backwards way of saying store A into the stack. Now here's a case if you're debugging and you wanted to keep clear what was going on, you could generate a comment and say, okay, what was the name of this variable, I think? It's called a 0th variable. Its name was in printout, store into, and printout A. And that way you'd have a better handle on what in the world does it think it's doing. It's storing into variable A. So it read an integer onto the stack. It's taking the integer onto the stack and putting it into the frame for that particular call of main. So it's done with the read. Next thing it wants to do is go ahead and do some prints. As you learn when you're doing type checking, a print of a list of things is nothing more than a print of the first thing done, print of the second thing done, print of the third thing done. You saw that when you were doing the unparsing, for example. You'll see it also when you do the code generation. So printing a list of things is purely a simplification for humans. You have to write a little bit less. But it semantically means print the first thing done, print the second thing done, etc. And that's what we're going to do. So the first thing was print a string. So the way we print a string is we can actually put the string in quoted form. That's why you never translated your quoted string from the scanner into expanded form with the quotes missing and the escapes removed. Because it turns out Jasmine wants it in quoted form with escapes present. So we're simply going to take it in that form, and we say load constant. LDC is load constant, so it's going to convert that string into the string object, and it's going to put a reference to that onto the stack. And that's a constant, so it's going to load a constant reference onto the stack. So it does that. And then that's what we're going to do is we're going to print string. So I invoke a static method called csxlive.printstring. It takes, in this case, an object of type string, java.lang.string is the standard string definition, and it returns void. So I've called the print routine for a string by first pushing the string constant and then calling the print routine. Next thing I have to do, going back here, is compute 2a plus 1. So I'll first compute it, where? Onto the stack, and then I'll print it using a print integer routine. So in this case, what I'm going to do is load constant 2. That's actually the number 2, value 2 onto the stack. Load the integer value from offset 0, that's A, onto the stack. I multiply means take the top 2 items, do an integer style multiply, remove the 2, and put the product on the stack in its place. I'll then load constant 1. So now I have the partial product and 1 sitting on the stack. Do an integer add, takes the top 2 elements, replaces it by the sum. So at this point, after the I add, I have 2a plus 1 computed and sitting on the stack. I then call the method csxlive.printInteger. It takes 1 element off the stack and prints it as a side effect and clears it from the stack, returns void. I then load constant 10. Remember I said we were going to treat characters and booleans and integers all as integers. So even though I'm printing a character, you've already gone ahead and converted the character to its integer format. That is, if you have a character code of 20, you have that 20 stored. In this case, the new line character is decimal 10. Just look it up on the ASCII character set. So I push 10 on the stack, but it's not the integer 10, it's the character 10. And the question is, how do I know that? I know that because the type checker did some type checking. And he said, at this stage, you're pushing a character literal on the stack. So I'll put the value 10, which is the character code for that, but we're going to treat it as a character. And in fact, what's going to happen right down here is I'm going to call cxslive.printchar, or print character. It takes a character on the stack, actually the character code, and returns void and has a side effect of printing it. And at this stage, I printed out the string that said answer equals, computed and printed the number, and then the new line just so that I force myself to a new line. Remember, in our simple language, we don't have print and print line. We just have print. But everybody who's done any programming knows if you got print, you got print line, if you want to just add the new line character wherever you want it. So we're making it, the program do a little bit more. But remember, we said if you wanted to have a fancier language, you could, for example, add print line into CSX. I don't know if it's the world's greatest invention, but, you know, sort of thing like, you know, there's certain inventions that aren't really very sexy, but they're very useful. You hear about all the Nobel Prizes given out for this or that. But I've always thought somebody ought to have gotten a big prize for invention of the Ziploc bag. Think about something that is so fundamental. I mean, I use it almost every day. You put your lunch in a Ziploc bag. You have some spare change you want to put aside, put it in the Ziploc bag. And I don't know who it was, man or woman, who invented the Ziploc bag, but it was a good thing to have done. And you're not as famous in history books, but people bless you all the same. So you can still do things in programming languages. Think of print line as like the Ziploc bag. It's not the world's greatest intellectual achievement, but it's a darn handy thing to have around. And that's something you could consider adding. So at any rate, at this stage, we've hit the body of the program. Hey, wait a minute, it generated a return. How did I know to do that? Remember back in Project 4, we had a rule that says there's an implicit return added at the end of every method. Why is that? Because people like you or me are kind of lazy, and we don't like to type return where the bottom of a program is an implicit return. So our code generator will say, if you didn't generate a return, I'll generate one anyway. But it's not going to do it in a very smart way. What would you imagine it's going to generate if I had a return, which I certainly could have had? I could have certainly typed the return right after that print. What would you imagine the code generator is going to generate if I type a return? Two returns. Duh. I'd be saying, oh, that's terrible, but it's not, because it works, and it's simple enough that it's not going to go wrong. The second return is unreachable. Who cares? You wasted one instruction. Just say big deal. I was going to say big something deal, but I'm in polite company, so I won't. So here's a case where sometimes doing what looks like the dumb thing is really the smart thing, because you've all done enough coding now that anytime you make something unnecessarily complex, you're asking for trouble. Every additional bell or whistle is something that's going to kick you in the behind at some point in the future. So the fewer kicks you get, the more fun you have. And the jargon usually is kicks are fun, but for me, where I get them, they're not. So that's what happened there. And then here's the case where Mr. Posner here is going to hate it. I said, limit stack 25. It wasn't 25. The stack had no way of getting on 25 deep, but I was too lazy, and I said, what's a big round number? No, 2-3 is too small, a million is too big, 25 is a nice round number. Now, what we could have done here is computed how many stack spaces I need. Turns out parameters are pushed on the stack, operands are pushed on the stack. In this case, probably we could have gotten by with 3, maybe 4. I'd have to double check. But this is a case where I'm going to simply suggest putting a big number like 25, crossing your fingers and saying, I hope it doesn't give me something that's too complex. How could I get something too complex? Well, the simplest way is give you a method that has 26 parameters. There's nothing in your type checker or in our code generator that says 26 parameters are forbidden. So one of the things you could do is count the maximum number of parameters and make sure it's at least that big. But we're even being lazier than that. We're saying 25 is good enough. This is our first compiler. You know, it's like your first car or something. It doesn't have to be absolutely perfect. I was driving in today, and I saw somebody who looked like they were from Verona High or something with their first car. And I could tell it was the first car because as it drove by, it had the bumper duct taped onto the rest of the body. So somebody said, oh, the bumper just fell off. I'm still going to drive. Get some duct tape, which is the world's greatest repair element, and duct tape it together and keep on going. So we're going to do the same thing. So our local 25 stack, a limit stack 25 is like duct tape. We're going to say it's going to run for a good long time, but we want to be honest about what we're doing. In this case, limit locals 1 is accurate. We simply counted how many local declarations there were. There was just 1, so this is how many I need. And then end method says, got no more for the method. And this whole gizmo, if put into a file and fed into Jasmine, will create, and you can try it if you'd like, you know, particularly when you get everything implemented, will create a class file which, when run, will accept input and do compute 2+1, print out the answer, and away you go. So this stage, and here's a little bit about Jasmine and so on. Question, yeah. CSXlib is a little folder I have distributed with the original handout that has all the library routines pre-coded that generated code using my class notes will need. So it's just like the libraries you find in other languages, but those particularly that CSX code generator must have. If you throw away CSXlib, you're doomed if you want to do anything that does I/O, for example, and certainly at least output to test your program, because it's not going to know where to find those routines that implement print string or print integer or print character. Just mostly so that you would have your hands on what it was doing for testing and debugging, and if you wanted to improve upon it, you could. The CSXlib should be in there. It's in there somewhere. If you ran the initial test, the initial test prints out 602, and so it's got to at least do the integer output. It is sitting there somewhere. And it's mostly there because I didn't want to assume people. One of the weaknesses of Java, it's done I/O in such a complex way that I wanted to kind of step back and say, here's the basics. Don't need to have a heck of a lot of fancy things to do the basic I/O. But again, if you want to enhance the I/O quality, that's certainly one of the things you could do. So any other questions on that? Yeah, in the back. It will in our generation because we want to be able to track how many definitions of locals you have. See, what we're going to do is, if we have blocks which have locals within them, we're going to have all the locals for all the blocks, including nested ones, all allocated at the level of the method that contains those blocks. So since we don't know towards the end until how many blocks we're going to see, we're going to wait until we have an exact count. I could try to go back and reinsert it up top, but there's no need to do that. I can put it anywhere in the method, and at the end seems the logical place to do it. Other questions? Well, one of the big questions is, how are we going to generate all this stuff? And particularly, we've got to do it in only a couple of weeks. So that comes up to the notes I've been handed out. And I mentioned that in Piazza that people should be printing and looking at code generation notes. There's probably some people who still need copies. So let me... I didn't know quite how many to print out, so let's see if I guessed right. Oops, I think there are two. Are there two there? Yeah. No, you don't want to be last on this line. No, it looks like I'll have enough. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Cool. I estimated just about, well, maybe not. Yeah. So what I'm going to do today and into next class, next week, is talk about these degeneration notes. Now what happens is, if you look at the assignment we were just reading through, there's a couple of pages of boxes that say do this, do that, whatever. The stuff in these boxes are absolutely correct, but they're very, very terse. And the trouble with this level of terseness is if you make even a minor mistake in implementing something, it may come back to bite you when it's too late to really correct anything. So what I've done instead is create a much more detailed set of notes, and it's what we just talked about, and let me see if I can bring that up. Excuse me, what? Oh, you want it a little bigger, you're saying? Yeah. Oh, I didn't want to do that. Oh, it's up here. Different commands at different levels. Even bigger? Or is that good enough? Bigger still, okay. No, that's good? Okay. You gotta be careful. I'm originally from New York State, and there you don't get thumbs up, you get something else up, and usually it's not a positive, it's a negative. It's their way of saying we're number one. And so anyway, what's gonna happen here is that I'm starting out with some of the simpler issues you're gonna have to deal with. But as you will see, a lot of this looks like it's pretty close to real code, and that's intentional. It's not like you can take this stuff verbatim and compile it and it'll run. But it's a situation where paths and qualifications and so on are intentionally included to make it less likely you'll make these little errors, which would derail your project. So what I want to do is go through here, explain what's going on, and make sure you're clear on what you need to do. So what you're going to start things out is you're going to call code generating. And again, that's going to just take a file into which you do standard print statements, print or print lines, normally one command line, one instruction per line. And because it's in this form, as you're testing your code generator, you can simply go ahead and look at the generated code and decide whether or not this or that particular component looks valid. So we'll start out with simple things. And what you're going to need to do first off, and we were talking about this in office hours yesterday, is in places where you had address and kind information in the type checker, you're going to need to add a third kind of information, which we call address or adder. And that means it'll probably go in two places. One, it will go in your AST at the expression node level. Remember, at the expression node level, you have type and kind, so the type checker sets it. And here, what we're going to do is store in the AST as we're doing code generation some partial information about where addresses are to be found. We'll also want to add in the symbol table node, the thing that you had in the symbol table. Remember, now you have links to the symbol table created by the type checker that had type and kind info. So if I'm working with variable A, I say, what's his type and what's his kind? And now I'm also going to say, what's his address? So here are the kinds of address modes we'll have. Global will mean it's essentially a field in the class, and that'll be accessed via a label. I mean a real honest-gosh label. If the field's named ABC, the label will be ABC. Local means it's in a frame. We saw one of those just a moment ago. It'll have an offset 0 or 1 or 2, saying I'm at offset 0 in the frame or 1 or 2 or whatever. And that's where we'll find all the local variables. Stack means it's currently sitting on the stack. So if I compute A plus 1, unless I move it, it's on the stack. And I may want to know that. Literal means that I don't have an address for it or a location for it. I have the value of it. That turns out to be handy because one of the optimizations that I don't do, but you may want to do, is something simple called folding. And folding is a very common optimization, not quite as simple as you might imagine, but it simply says if I have a well-known, well-defined operator, like plus, minus, equal, not equal, blah, 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 and all the operands are literals, I can pre-compute the result. Now, what our code generator will do, minus your optimization, will actually compute it. That means if I say, compute me a 1 plus 2, it'll go ahead and push 1 on the stack, push 2 on the stack, do an addition operation, computing 3 onto the stack. If you do that, you won't be punished. That's what my code generation notes ask you to do. but it's clearly not optimal. What you can do instead is say, as an optimization, if I see a binary op node, both of whose operands are literals, if they're literals, I know what their values are, I'll simply go ahead and pre-compute the result and put that in as the result of the operation. And therefore, what I do is I would load 3 rather than compute 3 using fewer instructions. It's a minor optimization, but it's still useful. Why do I say it's a tad tricky? Well, you better be careful if somebody writes down something like that. It's perfectly valid for a user to write that. What will happen is that the IDIV, I believe, that does integer division will throw an exception if you do a zero divide. It's one of those errors that nobody ever really seems to do very much, but still exists. But if you do that in your compiler, what will happen is, unless you're careful, you say, let's compute I over J, I happens to be 1, J happens to be 0, you'll get an internal division error in your compiler, and your compiler will abort. And that's certainly not acceptable. You all know in quality code, you expect the users to make all sorts of errors and try to trap each one of them, but you're not allowed to make your own errors independent of what the user forced you to do. So this sort of thing is there, but again, that's a fairly simple thing to handle. Yeah?
I don't think a compile-time error is better than a runtime error.
No, it's not a compile-time error. The compiler dies. Your compiler... Right. You won't even know necessarily that it was a zero divide problem. You'll say there was a divide error, and you may or may not be aware. I mean, you don't know it was at line 1,000 where there was a divide. So it's, hey, maybe it was trying to do a division internally. Yeah, so it's normally, am I correct? And is Epic Software allowed to do an abort and say goodbye and we're aborting out? I assume that's probably not what users they may see it, but they don't expect to see it. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just that. So it's got to be a little careful. But internal errors that aren't carefully phrased are bad, and certainly not going down to the rest of the compilation. You know, saying what you would say right here is this is an illegal expression, and you know it may not be computed or something. But anyway, it's philosophy, but that's what you need to be careful of. So at any rate, we've got this, and this is pretty easy to understand. What you're going to need to add into your AST nodes at the expression node and below, and also the symbol table, is extra information based on the setting of that address mode. And this will be used, and let me show you what it is down here. And the way I did that is simply by adding extra fields into the symbol table and into the area in the AST node where I had type and kind information. Now I'll have address information, and I'll have this extra information, which will be pertinent depending on what the value of address setting is. So saying if I am a global, that's one of my settings, then a string named label will actually have the string contents of the label of that field, that global that I want. If it happens to be a local, I'll have an integer that's the index, 0, 1, 2, etc., that says here's the offset in the frame for this local variable. If it's a literal, depending on its type, if it's integer, boolean, or char, I'll store it as an integer, 0, 1, whatever. If it's a string literal, I'll actually have the string value. If it's stack, I don't need any extra information. It's simply sitting in the stack. And none is this extra thing that we just use to say no address information is available yet. That's typically used before you've computed addresses. So it's one of these undefined flags. And in that case, we won't have any fields. It's simply that you should be aware that the address information is not been properly set yet, probably because we haven't completed the address processing. So we'll have to have that available, and I'll reference that a lot. Well, we're going to have to generate code, and one of the ways of doing that is to have a lot of little utility routines. In many cases, they're as small as this guy here. Let me put them up a little bit just so people in the back can see, but we'll just look at the first one initially. And you can name this what you want. I'm just, load stands for load, obviously, I for integer. And in this particular case, it's going to put an integer value, an integer literal, in fact. So maybe I could have called that load integer lit or something, but I was a little lazy. It takes a parameter that's the value I want to put on the stack. Now, it turns out that the instruction we use is a load constant. So at this spot where it says generate a blah, 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 what does generate A mean? It says write a line to your ASM file. And notice these lines typically will have a mixture of literals and variables. The LDC is alliteral. That means you're going to do print, quote, LDC, spacer, tab. And val is the integer parameter, so that'll be read off and whatever the user gave me. So if it says load I 10, I'll generate a load constant 10 into the ASM file as the next line generated. And there'll be a lot of these. So as long as you understand what this is doing, this is pretty straightforward. You're going to have one of these, and whenever I need to put a constant on the stack, an integer constant, I call a load I. Similarly, I may want to load a global integer field. Global means that it's a field. Field means it has a label. So the way I do that is I generate get static. That's a fixed literal. Class, as the note up here assumes, is it's going to have the name of the CSX class being actual processed. So as I start code generation, in my generator, I have in my code generating class a shared global variable, a static field that is named class, and it has the name of the class being processed. And that's very important because we know that we don't ever have a CSX program that doesn't have class. So all our programs have class, and in this case, we'll know where to find the class. So in this case, it says get static. Class will be the value in that field that you've already predefined or pre-initialized with the name of the class being processed. The name is a parameter, and the capital I means my type is integer, and that's got to be put there as part of the type code. So it says, get me a static from the class with name whatever, and its type is integer. If I want to load from a frame, it's even simpler. Load means load. I load means load me an integer, and the index is an integer 0, 1, whatever, saying this is the offset in the current frame of the local variable I want loaded onto the stack. At some stage, we may need to generate a binary operation. That turns out to be really easy because we've pushed operands on the stack, and all we have to do is give it the right opcode. So we simply generate the opcode. Later on, we'll see what they are, but they're things like integer add is I add, integer subtract is I sub, etc. And we'll be glad to give you any and all of the opcodes you need if you have any questions about what's appropriate for the various operations. When we're doing relational operators, those are a tad more tricky, and we'll go into more detail on those. But the simple ones like add, subtract, multiply, divide are pretty easy. Even things like and or, where you have two Boolean values and you and or them together. So for loading, we also have to be able to store. So in this case, if I want to store a global integer, I have a string, again, that's the label, and I generate a put static, class is that variable containing the class of I'm translating, slash is generated as a slash, and name is the parameter. Store local integer is an I store with the index passed in as a parameter, the offset. So that being the case, hey, look at this. We're already getting to visit methods. Let's go this far. So these are actually things that will translate completely and totally certain simple AST nodes. So once you got these down, some of your AST nodes are completely handled with respect to code generation. That means your code generating, say, touch that node and say, please do your code generation trick, execute that method, and it'll do it. So let's see what that means. So it says, here's an integer literal node n. So remember, integer literal nodes have in them the integer literal they're associated with. So it says, what do I want to do? I'll do a load integer. I'll fetch the int value from that node, n dot whatever, and I'll save the address as saying that I have a literal. It also is put on the stack, so I really is both on the stack and literal. But I want to know, you know, I have the literal value in case I want to do some level of optimization. Character lit is very similar. I take the char value, literal, and I store the character value. True is implemented as 1, and false is implemented as 0. So all of a sudden, 4 literal nodes are handled. Essentially, I put a little thing on the stack, and that's the effect of translating it. Now we get one that's a little more complex, name node. And what I'm going to do on this one is actually expand it slowly. Name node is fairly complex, so we'll take the simplest core part of it first. That is the part where the name node is a simple node where it's not an array and it's not being indexed. So we'll happen up here and say, how do I know if a name node is being indexed or not? I simply go at the field called subscript value and ask, are you null? If you're null, I'm a simple variable. If you're not null, there's an index value. So currently, I'm going to just take is null being true, so there's no subscripting. And I have a little comment that says, I'm handling a simple unscripted identifier. So I say, are you a scalar? How do I say, are you a scalar? I say, are you a variable or a value? And most particularly, not an array. If that's the case, I simply say, well, I want to put you on the stack. Well, there's two possibilities. One is that you're a field that is a global. The other is that you're a local. How do I tell? I check that address field I just got done talking about. I say, go into the var name, get your ID info. What was the ID info? That's that pointer backwards into the symbol table node that was created when the particular variable was declared. And I'm going to say, is your address field global? If you are, I get the label and I do a load global. Otherwise, you're a local. I get the offset and do a load local. And I'll handle arrays later. I record the fact that he's now on the stack, and I'll handle later the fact that I have a subscripted variable. So, okay, pretty good. We're starting to handle names. And I talked about opcodes, and here's how I select opcodes. If you have the notes in front of you, you might want to mark this because this has to be expanded. What I'm giving you here are the first few, and you'll have to add extras. So this simply says, if I'm doing a plus, the code to be done is I add. If I'm doing a subtract, it's I sub. It's I mul or mult. I'd have to double check which. And I div for integer division and some others that we'll get to. But guess what? Now we're pretty much in a spot where we can now do simple binary expressions as long as we're not doing subscripting and as long as we're not manipulating arrays. And it's remarkably how simple some of this can be if you set up the code properly. Namely, I give you a binary opcode node. Remember, it has two children, the left and the right. So what I'll do is I'll first visit the left child and the right child. The effect of that will be to have it evaluate its operand. Remember, it may be an expression also. But when it's all done, it'll leave its value on the operand stack. So when I call these two guys, the left operand is pushed first, the right operand is pushed second. So they're in the expected order. I then say, let's look at my opcode that I have and get the corresponding JVM operation code. That's what that guy up top here does. And generate him as a binary op, and my expression will be on the stack. So that's how I do the vast majority of my expressions, is that simple. Translate the operands, be they literals or variables, get them on the stack, and do the binary operation. The stack will be pop off two values, do the computation, put on the result. If expressions nest, no problem at all. It's perfectly okay if I have A plus B plus C, for example. Remember, we have the rule that A plus B plus C associates from the left. So essentially, it pushes A, pushes B, doesn't add. That has the effect of leaving that expression on the stack. It then pushes a C, doesn't add, which has the effect of doing that. So big expressions don't matter. They're knocked about piece by piece by piece. So complex expressions don't exist. It's one of the things that people always wonder when they first learn about compilers is, here's a compiler that takes 10,000 lines, and it translates 10,000 lines perfectly. That's not at all what it does. What a good compiler does is take one line, translate it perfectly, and do it 10,000 times. And you laugh, but it's a very different concept. It's saying the best software does not try to be complex. It tries to do simple things right and does it over and over and over again, where you actually get the accuracy and the speed of the machine in your favor. And that's exactly what this is showing. If it translates an immense expression, it doesn't translate immense expressions. It translates little expressions bit by bit by bit, but the effect is to get the entire expression. Now, that seems second nature to you, but to a lot of people, it's not. People think computers in general do complex things. In general, they really don't. They do simple things, but do it repeatedly and in combination. And I'm sure your best software does exactly that, that it keeps things simple. And because it keeps it simple, it's possible to do it right all the time. A question? Where? Oh, yeah. No, that's what I was talking about. Let me go back to that and restate that, because it seems like a subtle thing. Go back to... Yeah, right here. What's happening is in your type checker, what I suggested in the type checking notes is when you look up an identifier in the symbol table, you say, who's my declaration? You end up getting a symbol table node back. And the symbol table is going to go away, but what you do is you store a link to that particular symbol table node in your AST node saying, here's a symbol table node that I'm associated with. So it's like putting somebody on speed dial. So if you need to get them, you can get them real quick. And what this is doing is it's using the speed dial. It's saying, here's a var name. I looked them up in the symbol table in type checking part 4. And when I found them, I stored a thing which I happen to call ID info. You might have a slightly different name. But that's a pointer to the symbol table node that I already know is associated with him. Now, what's happened is I processed declarations early on. I haven't gotten to that part yet, but declarations will be processed, and information will be added, like are you a local, are you a global, what's your address, what's your label, and I'll have access to that. So this says, okay, I already know what the symbol table I'm associated with is. Please go ahead and check the adder field. And the adder field will then be local or global, depending on where my symbol table entry was placed, and I don't have to look it up again. So it seems odd, but the symbol table is completely gone now. It was simply mapping me. It's like a phone book where you copy all the relevant numbers onto your speed dial or onto your phone's memory. Once you have that, you don't need yellow books anymore. In fact, have you folks been getting yellow pages type books sitting on your doorsteps recently? It's amazing. I feel almost embarrassed. The guy drops it. There's all this paper here. I drop it too, but guess where I drop it? That's right. It happened that they delivered it on the day we had garbage. So I went outside, pushed the garbage cans out, and I said, oh, looks what's sitting on my doorstep. Yellow pages or the other one that competes with the yellow pages. Picked them up, because, you know, a little dirty, a little greasy sitting there, and dropped them in the garbage bin, and goodbye, goodbye. So all these people, you know, who are in the yellow pages business are essentially goners. I mean, how long is it going to last? Does anybody have an idea how much longer they're going to print yellow pages for ordinary people? I can't believe it's going to be very long. I don't know, but one of these things. So it's amazing how quickly technology, just 100 plus years ago, most people didn't have phones. Is that right? Yeah, I guess they were just coming in, but most poor folks didn't have phones. So in the space of 100 years, you go from having a phone book because you have a phone to not having a phone book because you have a real phone. It's amazing. So anyway, that answers that, I hope. Uh-huh. Right. Well, what happens is we put in the spot where it's most likely to be used, or it's most immediately going to be used. And if it's on the stack, you want to know it's on the stack. Situation. Remember, what you did is you did a load, and the load says, get me the value and put it on the stack. And once that's happened, the global value could, in fact, have disappeared. We know it's not, because that's not the way languages work. But if it's on the stack, it doesn't matter anymore. So I've got my copy. It's like doing a backup or something. If I do a backup now and my hard drive fails, it's not as terrible as if I didn't do a backup. So what the address is saying is, for my purposes, the code I'm generating right now, where should I expect to find it?
For example, a binary op node,
mm-hmm.
it's always going to be on the stack.
No, nothing's on the stack till I put it there.
Right, okay. What I mean is, you have that line and that error
right.
Equals stack.
Right.
If the binary op node has a value, that value is going to be on the stack, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in our approach, that's true. But it turns out some instruction sets have things like increment or decrement. That it implements plus plus or minus minus. And those things sometimes are implemented as the plus plus or the minus minus, the add one or subtract one, is in the opcode. And you only have one operand on the stack. We're not going to do that because we don't need it, and it's what I was talking about a minute ago. The more bells and whistles I add, the more ways I have to screw up.
Is there any way that the binary op node wouldn't be on the stack?
Its operands would be on the stack the way we're approaching it, because all our opcodes expect two operands on the stack.
Okay, so this line of code here, end that adder equals stack, it's not strictly necessary.
That's right. That's right. It's simply, but if I didn't put it there, then some bright student would say, hey, you got an undefined field there. What should it be?
And we need to put in some logic saying, if the type is binary opcode, then that adder is.
Right.
That's
right. This is the case where I don't think we're going to use this as much, but it's one of these truth in advertising. Where is the value going to be when I'm done? It's on the stack. I could make a default if it's not anywhere else, assume it's on the stack. But yeah, making things defaults are oftentimes a little dangerous, because what was the famous philosopher from Great Britain, Benny Hill, that says, when you assume, what happens?
You're assuming I know what the guy said.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So, but I get paid for it, so I'm okay. Not as well as Benny Hill did, but it's okay. But for those of you on history, Benny Hill was what, in 1980s, was it, or something? Kind of a rock, 70s? Yeah, raucous, English, low-class comedian who was very popular here for a while. Okay, so one of the things I was getting up to here as we're doing assignments is, if you look at assignments, there's been an oddity that you've seen 100 times and probably not ever thought about, ever, those 100 times, maybe 1,000. If I have something like A gets B, and A and B are plain old variables, do you realize A on the left-hand side and A on the right-hand side do not mean the same thing? If you learned about programming, they told you sometimes about things called L values and R values. It's kind of complex. But we're going to have to recognize this in the compiler. What that means is, when I translate the A of the assignment and I translate the B of the assignment, I am going to translate them differently. Why? Well, it turns out the left-hand side of an assignment's got to be a variable. When I have a left-hand side, I normally mean to have an address. That's why, for example, I can't assign to 1 plus 2, because that does not have an address. That's on the stack. It's not in memory. But this says I'm going to have to put data somewhere. That's the operational view, where this thing can be a value. But they're both variables. And we've come kind of to expect that by context, we can tell a variable in the context of an assignment is different than a variable in the context of a use. Similar thing when it happens when we do a read versus a print. When I see read A, that does not mean evaluate A fully to a value, because I'm reading. That means something's going to change. My old value is totally uninteresting. It means rather get an address, an L value for the A, call a library routine to get a value and assign it in. So this is really kind of shorthand for A equals read. And that's actually how we implement it. We don't write it that way, but that's actually what happens. And similarly, print is more like the right-hand side. It says evaluate the expression, put it on the stack, call a routine which will take the value, and print it out suitably using a library routine. So what that means is that when we have a left-hand side versus a right-hand side, when we treat the left-hand side differently, we're not going to visit a left-hand side node, be it target of an assignment or the target of a read, and translate it into a value. Well, how are we going to know to do that? Well, we're going to stay one level away, and when we see something where the subtree ought to be a location, we're going to go ahead and not compute its value, but rather compute its address. So this little compute address is what I use for left-hand sides of assignments or targets of a read. It says set up a read, or I should say set up an assignment, but don't actually compute the value onto the stack. It may later have to put some stuff on the stack if, for example, it's an array. We're getting a little ahead of myself. We are. But if I had something like A sub I gets 1, this will actually have to put something on the stack, but not the value of A sub I. What it'll put on the stack is the address of A, remember, arrays are objects, and the value of I. And it'll just leave it sitting there pending the computation of what the right-hand side is. And then I'll call an opcode that takes not one operand, not two operands, but three operands. It'll take the array, the index, and the value to be assigned, and in one immediate operation, we'll compute the address of the element, get the value, shove it in the element, and pop all the stuff off. So pretty fancy stuff, but we have to set it all up. So what we're going to have here is compute address, and that's going to take a name node. And notice it says here, even in boldface, don't put the value on the stack. I don't want that. I want you to go ahead and set up the assignment. Maybe you'll have to push something on the stack. Maybe you're not. Maybe all I need to do is set some address information that I can use later when I do the assignment. So let's see what it's going to do. It says, are you a simple unsubscripted variable? At this stage, that's all we care about, so the answer better be yes. So it says, let's go ahead and check the kind. Are you a variable? And the situation there, I know that he's a scalar variable. I then check the ID info's address to say, are you a global or are you a local? And in that particular case, if he's a global, I'm going to save his label. And if he's a local, I'm going to go ahead and, in this case, save his index. So here's a case where I say, I have to have an address. But addresses are not purely numeric anymore. They're symbolic labels for fields, that is globals, and they're offsets for locals. But that's the same information. I'll save that, and I'll put that in the node so I can get it later. I'm not going to handle arrays or subscripting yet. A later version of the notes will do that. And we'll be handing those out today, but probably not getting them till next week. And now, all of a sudden, I have something to store something into an ID. And again, there's going to be something here that looks like it may be wrong, but it better not be wrong because I'm going to point it out. And if I do, I never point out errors if I can avoid them. So it's saying, let's go ahead and store into an identifier node. So you're going to say what? He says, if I'm a var or a variable, it's a scalar, I'm going to go ahead and get the ID address and store a global if he's global, and store a local if he's local. There's something odd in here. Does anybody tell me what it is? Well, I said, what is kind of value? Are values normally stored into? The answer is yes. No, the answer is no, but one time yes. It turns out that values, in terms of name constants, are assigned to once and only once. What is a name constant? It's really something that's initialized, that's an assignment, but then never changed. So what this thing is setting up here is if I have a const t equals 10, what's going to happen here, I'm going to have to actually generate an assignment early on in the code that creates the value 10, puts it on the stack, and drops it into the memory location associated with the const. After that, it'll never be changed again. But until I get that value computed and put into the variable, it has to be allowed. So what this store ID is storing an identifier used in the context of a declaration. That's why it allows that. By way of contrast, I have a store name. And store name is not used in the context of a declaration. It's used in the context of an assignment or a read. So in this case, it only expects a kind equals variable. So it says, are your subscript null, that is your scalar? If so, your kind is variable. And if you're global, I'm going to store a global int. If you're a local, I'm going to store a local int. So got that covered. And guess what? Here it is. What looks like a complex statement is really handled in, let's see, 1, 2, 3 lines. That's pretty cool. So this actually implements assignments. And it'll actually implement more complex assignments, as we'll see when we get later, but this is the basic. It says, what do we do when we want to do an assignment? First thing we do is compute the address of the left-hand side. How do I do that? I do the compute adder of the target location, the target name, and that gets me, is he a global, local, and what his label or his offset is. I then visit the source. Remember, that can be an expression. I can have something like, A gets B plus C minus D. So it's going to have to do a whole computation to get that value onto the stack, but it will. And then I do a store name, which will assume there's a value on the stack, and store a local or a global into the left-hand side variable, depending on the address information I fished out when I did the compute address. So I've actually gotten to the statements before I got into the declarations. But, go ahead. Down or up? Like this way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I go a little further. But not yet further. Okay, there. Kinds dot var and kinds dot value. Is there a reason you don't have kinds dot gram? Because you can store into a scalar parameter.
All right, but this is only in the context of a declaration. It's that magic thing where I mix a declaration and an assignment. It's handling that sort of thing. In the context where it's being stored, it'd be considered a name. What's happened is I got into this. What really happened is that this guy down here, store name, was created first. And I was putting it in all the places where I have to do stores, and I got back to a declaration. I said, oh, darn. What happened? I didn't quite say that, but equivalent of that, you know, we're a family type class here. So I said, oh, gosh, darn. I don't have a name in a declaration. I have an identifier. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. So I could go back and try to change my scanner and parser and all that stuff. No, that's way too much work. So all I did is take this method, store name, and translate them with a little detail, because I have to handle that value business, into store, into an ident. But the only place where that occurs in the context of declarations, and those are always scalars. If I had a richer language, I might. But even full languages like Java, notice, they don't really allow an assignment initializer to complex objects like arrays. I can certainly declare an array and call new to give me an array. But in those situations, the actual initialization normally has to be done by a call that shoots through the element saying, you're this and you're that and you're the other thing. So we're like standard language there. Okay, good. We'll take a little bit of break then, and we'll go ahead and finish up the rest of this and maybe get into number two, and I'll then pass out the other things for next week. See, it's almost quarter of, so right around 8 o'clock, please.